journey into the Bible and explore its hidden text and rich wisdom. Join Adel Kazilski Mondays at 1 p.m. for the trip of a lifetime.
Shavua Tov and Purim Sameach. Tonight today is Shoshan Purim. I hope everybody had a wonderful Purim celebration yesterday. There are still places around the world, particularly in Yerushalayim, that are having Shoshan Purim, which is the day after Purim, and walled cities celebrate Purim on this day. Hope everybody had a great time and fulfilled all the mitzvot accordingly. We are continuing learning the book of Exodus. We are in Parshat B'Shalach, and we're journeying with the children of Israel out of Egypt. We are not exactly completely free because we've only left Egypt for 3 days, and we still need to see the complete and final destruction of the Egyptians, which we are getting closer and closer to. And I'd love you to join with me on that trip. So for those of you that are at home or that have access to a Chumash, Five Books of Moses, you can turn to chapter 13, verse 21. Okay, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Chaf Aleph. We are going to be continuing from there, and we're going to see that the Jews in the desert actually traveled in style. How did they travel? Can you imagine traveling in a desert? I don't know if anybody's ever been to a desert. Certainly, even if you go to the land of Israel and you travel, say, from the Dead Sea down to Eilat, you can see what desert's all about. It's not the most hospitable place on the planet, and the weather conditions there can be pretty rough. So now just imagine, don't have to imagine it happened, but you can imagine in your mind that the Jews had to contend with this for 40 years, and they didn't have any modern conveniences as we have today. So how, in fact, did they manage to travel? Well, we're going to be told right now in verse 21. V'Hashem holech lifneihem. The first important thing is that Hashem went before them. They felt the presence of God. They knew that Hashem was with them. But how did he express the fact that he was with them? Yomom ba'amud anan lanchotam haderech, that during the day, there was a pillar of cloud that would lead them along the way. And a pillar of fire to give them light so that they could travel both night and day. So essentially, here we see these clouds of glory. There's a pillar of fire and a cloud pillar. And the Midrash goes and tells us a mashal about a king. A parable about a king who was judging his people, and he had his sons at his side. And on the way to the palace, the king took a torch and he walked in front of his sons so that he could illuminate the way for them. The royal ministers saw this and said to the king, "It's not for the king to go and hold the torch. Allow us to hold it. We can walk before your sons and light the way for them." And the king replied, "No, the reason I am holding the torch is not because I lack servants. I want to show the world how much I cherish my children. Because when people see this, they themselves will honor their sons." So here, that parable was given because that's the same thing here. Hashem wanted to show the whole world how much he cherished his children, the Israelites. He wanted all the nations to respect them and to honor them, and therefore he was the one, so to speak, that carried the torch before them. What was the torch? A pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, just for everybody to understand that not only was it a guidance, but it would tell them when and how they would travel. So when the pillar rose and it started moving forward, and when it rose, it was a sign for the Jews to pack up, and then it would start moving forward and the Jews would follow the direction of the pillar. When the pillar settled, and then the clouds of glory settled, and they said that the clouds over the Mishkan settled, then they knew themselves that they had to settle. Now, while we are talking about the torch in the front, they were in fact enwrapped in what we call the clouds of glory, both on the bottom, on the floor of the desert, on the top, and on all four sides. And so they were encapsulated in kind of like a very, very big bubble that didn't allow external forces to come in, whether it was wild animals or anything that would make it dangerous for them. Where they walked, imagine, they didn't go shopping for shoes before they left, right? They probably were walking barefoot. It smoothed down the sand. It didn't allow it to be too hot. It was very comfortable for them to walk. They had a cover on top of them, so it didn't rain or it wasn't windy. It was actually a very, very pleasant experience. And these clouds of glory followed them throughout their travels in the desert. Now, why, in what merit did they have these clouds? Because we are taught that it was in fact in the merit of our forefather Abraham. Now, Abraham, as you know, when he was very, very pained by his circumcision, it was the third day, he was sitting by the opening of his tent. He was trying to heal from his Brit Milah, from his circumcision, and three angels came to give him different news items. And it said at the end, what happened was that Abraham went with them to escort them. Now, firstly, as a rule, there is a halakha, that a Jewish law, that if you have guests in your house and they get up to leave, that you should escort them out of your house and a little bit of the way. You don't have to take them all the way. Today, it's a generally accepted practice that you walk them out of your front door, walk them into your driveway, see them get into their car, open the gate, and let them leave. Otherwise, see them to their car. Okay, it is a mitzvah of hachnasas orchem, of inviting guests, that you actually escort them. And where do we learn that from? We learn that from Abraham, because he escorted the angels afterwards. But having said that, nevertheless, because of that merit, later on, Abraham's descendants, the children of Israel, had the merit of Hashem escorting them right throughout their travels in the desert. And therefore, we have this idea of the clouds of glory and the pillar of cloud to lead them on the way, and by night, pillar of fire. And there's actually very interesting things about the pillar of fire, which we are going to discuss in our next segment, so I don't want you to go away. In the meantime, if you want to ask a question or you want to pass a comment, 34519 is our SMS line. 061-895-1019 is our Telegram number.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This is 101.9 Hi FM. I'm Adel Kozlowski. This is Mystical Texts, and we are traveling with the children of Israel in the desert. And we were learning about the clouds, the pillar of cloud that showed the Jews where to go during the day. And we are just about to discuss now the pillar of fire. Now, the pillar of fire at night wasn't just like an ordinary torch, because generally a torch, wherever you put it, will only light up exactly where you want it. It will shine on. And I know very well, because I actually was having dinner at some family. They didn't have lights. They put out a big torch, and all the torch did was actually light up the very spot at the table we were sitting in, but it did not light up anywhere else. This pillar of fire, on the other hand, provided illumination as bright as day. And that's why, if you go and look back at the verse, it says, Lecha'ir lahem lalechet yomam valayla. They were able to travel both day and night with it, meaning the night was as bright as the day was. Now, you really could be answering, like, what's going on here? Did they really travel day and night? Surely that was very exhausting for them. They had just finished making bricks in Egypt, and they had been slaves for so many years, traveling day and night for several days, okay, without rest could be really, really exhausting. But as I explained to you, they were completely surrounded by these clouds of glory on all sides, above and below as well, and they were completely protected from the heat, from the rain, from the cold, etc., etc. But what we're also told about these clouds of glory is that they, in fact, carried them like a chariot, meaning that they weren't even doing any walking. They were like passengers in a very large ocean liner, and they weren't even aware that they were moving. So they kind of like got into this bubble of the clouds of glory, and they were taken away. So that's the explanation of how they were traveling, and understanding that God wasn't taxing them too much, and then in understanding that the light at night was exceedingly bright, and it lit up the entire encampment. It wasn't that they were sitting in the dark, literally in the dark. Then one last line that we want to understand, and that's verse 22. By day, the pillar of cloud did not depart, nor did the pillar of fire by night from the people, meaning that this was something that went on forever and ever while they were in the distance. Because at the instance of nightfall, okay, at the instance of nightfall, the pillar of fire appeared, and at the instant of daybreak, the pillar of cloud was there. So they weren't without them for not even 1 minute. Another opinion said that every night the pillar of cloud moved around the camp. So the pillar of cloud would move around the camp and would go to the back. It darkened the road for the enemies of Israel who wanted to pursue them. And then the pillar of fire would come to the front. And if they were traveling by night, if they had to, they would have the pillar of fire in front of them, the pillar of cloud behind them. And so it was pitch bright for them while it was very dark for their enemies. And just another thing to understand, that in fact the mixed multitude, the massive bunch of Egyptians that came with them, traveled behind the clouds together with their livestock. They were not meritorious to have the clouds of glory surround them. So that was the idea with the clouds of glory. Now what we are going to start looking at is that there is a final setup, a final putting together on the chessboard to allow Pharaoh his final downfall. And so what we're going to see now is that they left Egypt, they've traveled for 3 days, and in fact what they do is they kind of sort of make a U-turn, like they were coming back to Egypt. Let's follow in. We're starting a new chapter. It's chapter 14, okay, verse 1. God says to Moshe, "Daber al bnei Israel, speak to the Jews, v'yashuvu v'yachunu lifnei pi hachirot, that they have to return, they have to go back, and they have to encamp in a place called pi hachirot, which I'm going to translate loosely as the Freedom Valley. Where was the Freedom Valley? Bein Migdol or Bein Hayam. It's between a place called Migdol and the sea. And what's most important over here is Lifnei Baal Tzafon. They had to encamp against or in front of a big idol that the Egyptians had called Baal Tzafon. Nechokoi Tachono Elayam, camp opposite it near the sea. So basically, what the Jews were doing is that they were making themselves stuck, because on either side there were mountains, in front of them was the sea, and behind them was Egypt. So God was actually putting them in a precarious position. But by God putting them in the precarious position, he was positioning history that now Pharaoh is going to change his mind, he's going to chase after them, and then the ultimate miracle, which is the splitting of the sea, is going to happen. Now, let's just talk a little bit about this Baal Tzafon, and then I want to tell you the most crazy story. And it's not so crazy, because you'll hear why. Don't go away. Okay. The Baal Tzafon was, the Midrash tells us, had the form of a gigantic, snarling dog. Now, when the Jews left Egypt, all the idols were destroyed. The only one that was left that God did not destroy was this Baal Tzafon that was just outside, on the outskirts of Egypt. Why? Again, part of the plan to give the Egyptians the ability to go and say, oh, well, this God is still alive, and this gives us permission to go and attack the Jews, okay? And really, this entire story comes around a discussion of free will. How much free will do we have if we believe that God is the ultimate being, that he's omnipresent, that he is guiding history, that he's looking after each and every entity in the world at all times, then how can we say that we have free will? And this is an entire discussion, and it can take days to start expanding it and understanding it. But what we need, I'm going to try to explain it in very shortly and in a few words, is that we have two concurrent train tracks running at the same time. The one train track is the view of God, who knows exactly what is going to happen, who knows what happened, what is happening, what is going to happen, and is guiding the world as such. And then there's the human being who's oblivious to the train track running next to him and is making choices every single day as to where he should go and what he should do. So you could be deciding right now that you're going to go on holiday on this long weekend to X, Y, and Z, and that is perceived by you as a free choice. At the same time, the concurrent train track that God knows that you are going to go or not go, you don't know. You're making a choice of free will, but God actually knows, because he is God. He knows what will happen and how things are going to pan out. So we go along with our free choice. And truthfully, what free choice do we have? We actually don't have too much free choice. We did not choose to be born. We are not going to choose when to die. We did not choose our parents. We did not choose the place we were going to find ourselves to live in. We didn't choose the color of our eyes. We actually don't choose anything. All those things are chosen by God for us, chosen by our soul for its purpose in this world. And when we find ourselves in difficult situations, we must know that we're never in the wrong place at the wrong time, but rather we're in the right place at the right time, because the circumstance in which we find ourselves has been chosen by that concurrent train track that God is running. Then how do we choose? How we choose and what we choose, where we do have a choice, is whether we decide to choose good or bad in the situation that we find ourselves in. So really, you think that you're making a choice about where you're going on holiday. In truth, not. You're going to be compelled kind of to make that decision of where to go and what to do. But when you find yourself in whatever situation, I find myself in a situation right now, today, I can choose to either spend my time and learn Torah with you for an hour, or I could choose to go and do something else for that hour. So our choice really is in the choice of good and evil. And that is the sum total of the free choice that a human being has, because the overarching idea is that God regulates and manipulates and coordinates the rest of the world. So coming back to this, what we are seeing is that God was now putting together the scenario that will be the ultimate of the redemption with the splitting of the sea. He's going to corner the Jews. He's going to make them come stand right outside Baal Tzafon, which will then make the Egyptians look at it and understand that they've still got a God alive, and that God, that God was running the world. It would give the impetus for Pharaoh to decide such and start chasing the Jews. It will encapsulate the Jews. The Jews will have nowhere to go. And then the Jews will see the ultimate redemption, which will then allow for the splitting of the sea. Now, I wanted to share with you a story that is brought in the Midrash that is quoted by the Ma'am Loez, the Yalkut Ma'am Loez. It's actually quite a crazy story, but I've got to tell you, not so crazy, but you're going to have to listen to the story to understand why I'm going to tell you not so crazy. So here's the story. Let's start with that first. A Jew was once visiting a city by the name of Kedar. And in this city, the people would worship a live volcano that was near them. And they believed that the fire that was coming from this volcano actually was coming from the netherworld. And not only did they worship the volcano, they believed that the fire was in fact sacred. And they said that the fire was the first thing that was created, and that in this fire, all souls were judged. And so they worshiped the fire. They worshiped what was going on. Now, in their temple, there was a place where this volcanic fire would well up and would serve like a sort of an altar. And every morning, they would put two huge logs on this altar, and every evening, another two logs. And of course, this volcanic heat was so intense that the logs were completely volatilized, and it never, ever left any ashes. And that the people then made the choice that this fire was supernatural and it had divine powers. They had an even more crazy custom with this volcano. When the people in that city became old, the Midrash doesn't say how old, but old, they had the custom of taking their lives and throwing themselves into the volcano, because they believed that if they threw themselves into the volcano, that would result in complete atonement for any sins they might have committed. And it was said that one who threw themselves into this volcanic fire would go straight to paradise, which was directly opposite the volcano in the nether world. And if one did not sacrifice himself to the volcanic fires, then he would have to be judged in a place called Hadas for all his sins. And that basically constituted the belief of those people. So that's the background. This Jew was traveling to the city of Kedar with these people who have this crazy idea, and he stays with an old man. And he rests there for a few days before he wants to continue on his journey. And his next stop was going to be a nearby town, but it was known there that the road was infested with highwaymen, with robbers. And this Jew realized that it probably would be too dangerous for him to take all his wares with him. So he said to this old man, this Gentile man, can I leave everything with you, including my money, my extra clothes, and I will fetch it on the way back. And he was comfortable in doing that, because even though these people were pagans, they were extremely honest with regard to the belongings of others. So off the Jew goes to the nearby town, and he does what he has to do, whatever business he has to do there. And he returns a few days later to the old man to collect his belongings. And yes, you've guessed it. When he returned, he notes that the old man had suddenly become sick. He realized that his time of death was coming. And what did he do? He had gone to the temple and thrown himself into the volcano. So the Jew asks the members of the family, well, you know, I left all my belongings and my money and my merchandise, and none of the family knew anything about it. He was completely, completely thunderstruck. What is he going to do now? He had traveled the entire civilized world. He had done trading, into business. Now he basically lost almost everything. He was totally impoverished, and he didn't even have enough money to get back home. So he was really, really upset. He was very, very despondent. And one of the old man's relatives saw him like that, and they said, listen, don't worry. Whenever a person sacrifices himself to the volcano, he comes back on the third day to make his last will and testament. And then he goes back where he came from. So when he arrives, hang around here, wait the 3 days. When he arrives, you'll be able to find out where your belongings are. How's that for a weird story? It gets better than that, but you're going to hang on, because I have a live read now, and I'm going to finish the story after the break.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Okay, so this Jew waits for this so-called pagan Gentile to rock up, okay? And again, he was basing it on the fact that he knew that pagans were honest, they didn't lie, so he just actually waited. Well, guess what? On the day, an apparition appears. It looks exactly like the deceased old man. And this apparition comes and sits in the house of the old man's wife and children, and he tells them exactly how his estate should be divided. And to all appearances, the old man looked like he had come back from the dead. The Jew sat there. He was completely astounded. Finally, he gains enough courage to ask the apparition where his belongings were, and the apparition opens a large concealed drawer, and he says, here's everything that belongs to you. Not knowing what to think about this crazy, uncanny phenomenon, the Jew says to this apparition, Is it true you come from a place called Hades? He goes, yes, I was. He says, is it true you actually threw yourself into the volcano? Yes, I did. And anyone who sacrifices himself into the volcano has all his sins atoned and is not judged in the world beyond. The Jew still can't believe what he's hearing. So he says, I would like to go and see how you jump into the volcano again. So the guy says, I can arrange that. If you come with me, you also come into the volcano. Jump into this place with me. So the Jew goes, no, I'm still young. I'd like to go and see, and then I'll make up my mind. So the guy says, so this apparition says, well, if you're not sure, then don't go. And he leaves him, and he completes what he has to do. He divides his estate. He leaves his last will and testament to the family. He blesses them, and he walks off. And when he walks off, the Jew starts following him. This apparition turns back to the Jew and says, please don't follow me. So the Jew says, what do you care? What concern is it of you? I'm going to follow you to see where you go, even if it takes many days. I must find out how you return from the dead. So this apparition goes, you're a stubborn human being. Are you Jewish? So the Jew says very proudly, yes, I am Jewish. I am a Jew, and my father was a Jew. So the apparition says, so do you think that I'm a human being? No, he says, I'm not exactly sure, and that's why I'm trying to find out who the heck you are. He says, well, then let me tell you. He says, I'm not this old man. I'm not a human being at all. In fact, I am one of the agents of Satan. Okay? And Satan, as Satan, as we know, is the master of Gehenim, of hell. And he sends me to confuse these fools, because these fools have abandoned the true living God. And what do? They worship hellfire. And when one of these pagans throws themselves into the volcano, I returned after 3 days. I draw up his will just as he desired. I also tell people how great it is to sacrifice oneself in the volcano, because if they make a choice to do negative, then there will be the next negative thing will be available for them to choose, and vice versa. That's the end of the story. But the story is an exceedingly powerful one, because we know, in a way, there's a saying in the Talmud, in a way that a person walks, that is where he will be taken. Meaning, if you choose to cling to pagan ideas and pagan behaviors and negative behaviors, then you will have that negativity continue to visit you. If you choose to be a seeker of truth, a person who's opening up to what is really true in this world, then that is what is going to follow you. And if you don't really understand that, then understand it just in terms of what psychology is saying today. You are where you think, where you choose, where you want to go, okay? There's a lot of talk in modern pop psychology about manifesting good, or choosing to go somewhere. If you're going to go and make a choice, and it is a good choice, then good will follow, and vice versa. So this again comes back to why God went and put the Jews right in front of this Baal, this Lord of the North, as it's called. He allowed it to stay standing because he wanted to preserve the free will of the Egyptians, who still wanted to believe in their idol. And why did he keep specifically this idol? He kept this idol because they believed that each idol had an astronomical influence. And what influence did this idol have? It was a god of wealth. And they believed that if the god of wealth was still alive, then if the Jews were found in front of the god of wealth, this was a sign for them to go and attack the Jews so that they can get back all the wealth that the Jews had walked out of Egypt with. Because if you remember, in the days of darkness, the Jews had taken the Egyptian jewelry and precious stone and garments as payment. We discussed that. If you didn't understand it, you can go back into the podcasts and you can understand it there. So all the other plagues did not disturb the Egyptians morally, because they could see the tit for tat. Okay, they could see how each plague was a fitting punishment for the wrongs they had committed. But in the case of darkness, they couldn't understand it. And they thought that they had received an unfair blow. And that's why God puts all the chess pieces around and he says, play it out. God and his track knows they're going to make the wrong decision, but he's going to allow them to believe, as much as they allowed them to believe, these pagans, that the volcano, in fact, was a god. It's going to allow them to believe that, but that's going to be their downfall. Now, I told you in the beginning that's a crazy story, but not so crazy. I was reading this and chuckling to myself. Last year, I had the opportunity to visit Iceland. Very, very interesting place, a very, very intriguing place for anybody who has been there. And believe it or not, as anybody knows, geographically, Iceland is a place of volcanoes. In fact, there's been huge volcanic eruptions in the southwestern part, which is called the Reykjanes, I think, peninsula. In fact, my husband and I traveled on the very roads that are full of volcanic fire there. I can see we're going to go for a bit of a break. I'm going to tell you the rest of the story after the break. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
All right, let me finish my story. So we toured around Iceland, and very, very interestingly, this was, and to a large extent still is, a very pagan country. And they do believe in volcanic eruptions and that there are gods that are moving things around. Understandably, you know, when you don't have enough knowledge geographically of how and geologically about how things work, you know, you could think that they are the wraps of the gods. And in fact, in one place that we visited on the Reykjanes Peninsula, where the volcanic eruption was happening, was a place that looks like it belonged in Mars. It looks like we were walking in Mars. There was a lot of mud pools bubbling over there. They believe a lot in trolls, and they do believe that gods came out of these fires and mud baths. In fact, there was one big sign that spoke about a very ugly lady. I don't know what her name was. A very ugly troll, very, very scary. And there is a whole story around the fact that this ugly looking troll had a fight with a priest who came to try teach a different form of religion, and that she overcame him and threw him into this pot of boiling fire and water and mud. And when you stand there on the earth and you're hearing the bubbling and you're seeing the mud pools going blah, 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 and you could see the steam being blown out, and yeah, now you can even see the volcanic eruptions. They said that she wakes every single night and she cooks the priest anew. So when I was reading all of this, it sounded like really a far-fetched story. But in truth, those stories still exist. If anybody wants to verify them, go visit Iceland, and you will see they've got all these trolls and ugly-looking little midget human things popping out all over the place. And to a very, very large extent, people still believe in them. So it isn't so far-fetched that these people did what they did. But that's just a little bit of a tidbit on a story brought in the Yalkut Me'am Noez. Bottom line is that we do have freedom of choice, and our freedom of choice is about us choosing good or not good in the circumstances that God has given us. But from God's perspective, he knows exactly how we are going to behave at all times. Hope you enjoyed the show. This is Adel Kozlowski signing off. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. Shavua Tov, and again, Chag Sameach. And please God, we should only see good news and see things overturned early for good.